Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 19th, 2026. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on the GOP party. Then we'll move on to another article on the Democrats, then on to Valley and State news, and then conclude the first hour with national and world news from USA Today. Our first article is a feature front page article from the Republic. It's entitled Party Scrutiny. The subtitle is, Are These Arizona Candidates on the GOP Ticket Actually Republicans? This is by Ray Stern. Three Republican candidates for the state legislature in Goodyear and Mesa are drawing scrutiny for their fledgling GOP credentials. Their entrance into the 2026 primary race could upend the ambitions of more tenured Republicans running to represent those cities in the state house. In Mesa, Republican candidates John Pietrowicz and Fernando Manaros filed statements of interest in January for the two open state house seats in Legislative District 9, which covers West Mesa. Brad Betancourt, a Republican business owner who's been running for the House in Mesa since July, is suspicious of their qualifications. The district was identified by the 2021 Redistricting Commission as one of five competitive districts out of 30 total because of the narrow split between Republican and Democratic voters. It's a hot race for both parties in 2026. Incumbent Democratic Representative Seth Blattman isn't running again, leaving his seat open for a possible Republican takeover. Democrats want to put one of their own in that seat after November, while the district's other House incumbent Democrat, Representative Lorena Austin, wants to stay in office. Betancourt has raised $47,000 for his race so far, including $30,000 he gave or loaned himself. He hoped to employ the often successful single-shot strategy to achieve victory. In the scheme, only one member of a political party runs for both House seats. Voters' focus on a single candidate can mean a win when the opposing party offers two or more candidates for the two seats. But now, Betancourt has two primary competitors whose presence in the race will split their votes, potentially helping the chances of Jacob Martinez, the other Mesa Democrat running in the race. I've been a Republican since 18 years old, unlike John Pietrowicz and Fernando Manaros, who just switched to Republican within the past few months, Betancourt said in an email. He noted Manaros' endorsement of a Democratic candidate in 2024 and Pietrowicz's history as a Democratic voter. This gives the impression the establishment Democrats are scared of losing with candidates like Jacob Martinez, Betancourt wrote. If not, they should be due to our sensible Arizona policies, like supporting a family's right to choose educational options for the children and true fiscal responsibility. It scares a lot of people to go up against a candidate like me who can successfully communicate with our community in both English and Spanish. While intentions of the three candidates aren't known, the concept of someone running for office for motives other than winning isn't new. No specific law prohibits the strategy, but those who try it could be accused of violating laws, including fraudulent schemes. Democratic State Representative Jackie Thrasher lost her seat in the legislature in 2008 after a Green Party candidate with ties to Republicans siphoned votes away. In 2011, suspected sham candidate Olivia Cortez withdrew from the recall election of former state senator Russell Pierce, who lost the race. A lawsuit ensued over Cortez's participation, but a judge said evidence of fraud wasn't clear-cut in the case. Candidates don't have history as Republicans. Pietrowicz, a clinical laboratory scientist at Mayo Clinic, according to his LinkedIn profile, was registered as a Democrat from 2004 to January 2026 when he registered as a Republican, except for 2013 to 2014 when he registered with no party affiliation. He's a fan of Bernie Sanders, his Facebook page shows, and gave $166 to Sanders' campaign in 2016. He's given hundreds of dollars to the Democratic contribution site ActBlue since 2015. Pochervina didn't return a voicemail message. Businessman Fernando Manaras, an Iraq combat veteran who served in both the U.S. Marine Corps and Army, moved from Nevada to Avondale in 2013, online records show. But he grew up in Mesa and has connections there, he told the Arizona Republic. In November, he moved from Mesa to Avondale. He also changed his voter registration to Republican that month after previously being unaffiliated with a political party, county records show. He selected a Republican ballot for the 2022 primary election, but records show he didn't take a partisan ballot in primary races in other years. Asked if he moved to Mesa to run for the legislature, Manaras didn't have a clear explanation. He didn't move to Mesa for that reason, he said. He stated he moved to Mesa because I wanted to move to Mesa. However, he said that in retrospect, the move was the impetus he needed to enter politics. His friends and veterans groups told him he should consider running for something, he said, but they didn't mention going to Mesa. He now understands that what held him back from running in Avondale was that he wasn't in Mesa, where he said he has a ground game. Once in Mesa, I figured I'll run for office, he said. It's a purple district, pretty split when it comes to politics, he said. It's a good opportunity to run as a Republican. One of his biggest priorities would be education if he were to win the election. Schooling is important for the state's workforce development, and he's focused on trade schools, he said. Manaras said he realized after talking with a family friend that his core values, including the importance of family and God, made him more of a traditional Republican than an independent. He wrote in a LinkedIn post in December that he previously voted Republican all the time and had been helping GOP candidates for years now. Manaras started a campaign finance account, but hasn't documented any contributions or expenses yet. Online searches yielded no evidence of him helping GOP candidates, but a candidate website shows he endorsed former Democratic Representative Lorenzo Sierra of Avondale for re-election to the House in 2022. Manaras said he had a great relationship with Sierra, somebody I could talk business with when he lived in Avondale. He said he also has a good relationship with Austin, the Democratic House member in Mesa. We just have different views on how things should be done, Manaras said. Manaras downplayed his connection to Democrats and described himself as a conservative. He's a supporter of President Donald Trump and said he believes the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is doing a good job. Goodyear candidate previously ran as a Democrat. James Jimmy Holmes of Goodyear ran for Congress in 2022 as a Democrat. 2 years later, he ran for the open state House seat in Legislative District 23, also as a Democrat. He came in third among three Democrats, getting less than 3,000 votes. The split vote among Democrats allowed Republican Representative Michelle Pena to win a second term in office with her single-shot strategy. Democrat Representative Mariana Sandoval won the district's other House seat. Holmes is running for the same seat this year, but as a Republican. He filed for the office and switched his registration in May. Not doing this at anyone's bidding. Just figured I might have a better chance to win running as a Republican, Holmes said in an email. Water, affordability, CORE not paying fair price. Pro-choice, former Teamster, just want a chance to make a difference. Dems didn't want me, hence the change. Legislative District 23, which stretches out from Goodyear to Yuma, isn't one of the state's five official competitive districts. But it seems to work like one. Despite its Democratic registration advantage, district voters selected Pena in 2022 and 2024, along with Democrat Sandoval and State Senator Brian Fernandez. Pena's strategy doesn't look as good now. Besides Holmes, former Republican legislative candidate Gary Garcia Snyder jumped into the race in November. While Snyder ran for office as a Republican in 2022 and 2024, he was recently criticized as a charlatan by State Representative Nick Cupper of Surprise for attending an event with Democratic U.S. Senator Ruben Gallego. Statements on his candidate websites and other sites show Holmes is somewhat split on the issues, but appears to lean left. He told a Tucson newspaper in 2024 that too many people were crossing the state's southern border. But on one of his websites, he slammed the billions spent on Trump's deportation program and called the Empowerment Scholarship Account program, much loved by Republicans, a nearly $1 billion giveaway with little oversight. Pena is taking the development in stride. Everybody has a right to run, whether they're honest or not about their affiliation, she said. Hopefully, the voters do their due diligence and know who they're voting for. Pena is prepared for whatever they bring me this election cycle, she added. These are certainly unprecedented times we are living in, Jean Herman, chair of Legislative District 23 Republicans, said in an email. Although many candidates tell us what we want to hear to get us on board, the test is in what they actually do and not what they say. Pulling voting records, past and present, certainly lends insight, and all we can do is pray that they truly are who they say they are. And that article was entitled Party Scrutiny, and that was by Ray Stern. Now, our next top political article for this Sunday is entitled Dems Hoping Gas Prices Influence Voters. The subtitle is Poll, 76% of Americans Disapprove of Trump's Handling of Fuel Costs. This is by Philip M. Bailey. As rising gas prices force Americans to change their spending habits, Democrats are revving their 2026 midterm message on the potentially potent issue. The last time the average retail price to fill up went over $4 a gallon was August 2022. Republicans put a relentless focus on gas prices and successfully took back Congress, stalling the rest of former President Joe Biden's agenda. Now, Democratic challengers in swing districts and competitive states are looking to use the same weapon against Republicans by noting that President Donald Trump's ongoing war with Iran caused prices to skyrocket by more than $1 per gallon in a matter of weeks. The issue also helps Democrats position themselves as fighting for economic relief. Experts say price hikes in gas infuriate Americans more than increases for most other goods. It's a sign that people can't do as much as they want, Patrick DeHaan, an analyst at Gas Buddy, which monitors fuel prices, told USA Today. That's why rising gas prices become so bitter for Americans. It really feels oppressive in a different way. John Mark Hansen, a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, said the price at the pump is particularly visible for lots of people because we're a very car-dependent society, he said. When people go to the gas station, they have to shell out more cash or get charged more on their credit cards when they fill up. Global markets determine the price at the pump more than the president or Congress, he said. But Trump's fingerprints are more on the recent spike because the war he started led to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, which carries 20% of the world's oil shipments and about 20% of the world's seaborne liquefied natural gas. Moreover, Trump's attempts to take credit for lower gas prices earlier in his term may link him in voters' minds to the newly higher prices. President Trump has been touting low energy prices, saying, I'm going to be the one to drill, baby, drill, and now the chickens are coming to roost, DeHaan said, adding, if the U.S. hadn't taken action to attack Iran, we likely would not have seen oil prices jumping the way they have. A whopping 76% of Americans disapprove of how Trump is handling the situation at the pump, according to a CNN SSRS poll released March 31st. That includes 44% of GOP respondents and 83% of independents who gave the president a thumbs down on gas prices. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the political arm for House Democrats, launched six-second spots on Facebook and Instagram showing the rising price at the pump in late March. Those brief ads targeted about four dozen swing districts that the group believes can be flipped. It's part of their larger pitch on affordability to voters this fall, emphasizing what the DCCC describes as Trump's failure to lower costs on food, health care, and other utilities. Among Democrats' targets is Republican Representative Brian Fitzpatrick's district in Pennsylvania, where the average cost per gallon shot up by more than almost a dollar from early March into early April, according to AAA's average fuel prices. Democratic congressional candidate Bob Harvey noted that Fitzpatrick, who didn't explicitly support or condemn the airstrikes against Iran in February, voted against the March 5th War Powers Resolution in Congress to curb the president's actions in Iran and has supported other parts of Trump's agenda. "Quite frankly, people are pissed off," Harvey told USA Today. "Things are already rigged against them in terms of the benefits going to people at the top, and you've got members of Congress who are just letting all this happen, standing aside while Donald Trump runs this economy to the ground." The University of Virginia Center for Politics found gas prices and presidential approval ratings have been closely connected since the 1970s. That decade started with the oil embargo by Arab countries who were members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, and ended with the Iranian Revolution, which many attribute to helping end Jimmy Carter's presidency. The center's analysis, however, showed that in recent years, gas prices don't move the needle on presidential approval ratings as much as in the past. Experts also warn that those costs tend to fluctuate and may come down before November. But Democrats are betting that lawmakers in swing districts won't be as well insulated. And as the 2026 midterm elections approach, the party's pitch is clear. The Iran war is an expense that the average American household cannot afford. White House promises prices will plummet. Speaking to the nation in a primetime address April 1st, Trump touched on gas prices by repeating previous claims that this is a short-term situation, the fault of the Iranian regime's deranged terror attacks against commercial oil tankers in neighboring countries in the Persian Gulf region. "Once the conflict ends," he said, "then the Strait of Hormuz will reopen and prices will fall. They're going to want to be able to sell oil because that's all they have to try and rebuild," Trump said. "It will resume the flowing and the gas prices will rapidly come back down. Stock prices will rapidly go back up." White House officials point out that before the Iran war, families saved hundreds of dollars at the pump when a gallon of gas fell below $3 a gallon for the first time since 2021. The president will double down on that proven approach after the military operation concludes, officials told USA Today. During the State of the Union address in February, Trump bragged about how gasoline had fallen below $2.30. He mentioned a visit to Iowa where he saw $1.85 a gallon for gasoline. AAA says gas cost roughly $3.42 a gallon in Iowa in early April, up from about $2.63 a month earlier. Republicans broadly supported the administration's military action in Iran, but most GOP incumbents in competitive races have noticeably ducked addressing rising gas prices while defending the war itself. When the bombing began on February 28th, for instance, Fitzpatrick, the Pennsylvania representative, argued that a nuclear-armed Iran is not an option, and called the country the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism. For decades, the Iranian regime has methodically built a network of terror, proxy militias, missile proliferation, and regional coercion designed to destabilize the Middle East, threaten American interests, and openly calls for the destruction of sovereign nations, the Pennsylvania congressman said in a statement. Fitzpatrick, who has condemned Trump's rhetoric on cultural issues, joined other House Republicans in rejecting a war powers resolution in March, thus paving the way for the Middle East conflict to continue. He said little about the gasoline hikes after that. That contrasts with how the congressman was joined at the hip with Trump in October 2025, when regular gasoline was trending below $3 per gallon. The National Republican Congressional Committee said at the time the cost savings was a direct result of the GOP putting American energy first. Harvey, Fitzpatrick's Democratic challenger, said Fitzpatrick has failed to address the district's current needs or lobby for alternative energy sources that could be useful in the current situation. He pointed out that the Republican incumbent has taken campaign contributions from oil and gas companies and supported Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill that repealed subsidies for electric vehicles. Fitzpatrick sold them out over the summer by supporting Trump's budget bill, which took out money that was going to go to those kinds of programs, Harvey said. Asked how the GOP plans to fend off these types of attacks, NRCC spokesperson Mike Marinella said that while when Democrats reduce oil and gas drilling, as the Biden administration attempted to do, it also raises energy costs. If they cared about lowering prices, they'd stop catering to the far left and start supporting the pro-energy policies that deliver real relief for working families, Marinella said. Energy analysts say oil prices are set by global supply and global demand, not just domestic production. That is why American consumers are paying more for gasoline, even though the United States produces more oil than it consumes. I want him to be right. GOP holds breath. For Republican incumbents facing the brunt of voters' anger over how much it costs to fill up, there is little recourse. I want him to be right, Senator John Husted, Republican of Ohio, told Newsmax on March 19th when asked if the spike in gas prices was temporary. I want him to take the actions to make that so, he added. That's why I'm for a war that is brief and successful. Husted is engaged in one of the more critical Senate campaigns this year, one that could determine who controls the upper chamber. Former Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown is blasting his GOP rival about the increase at Ohio gas stations. Ohioans are already struggling to make ends meet, and now they're paying record prices for gas and diesel, Brown said in a March 31st statement to USA Today. Embattled Republicans have begun looking for other solutions. Representative Mike Lawler, Republican of New York, introduced a bill to boost domestic energy production. On March 20th, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, suspended the state's motor fuel tax for 60 days. Typically, said Hansen, the University of Chicago professor, the sitting president would be okay with members of Congress in their own party making space between themselves and the White House when an election is coming up. But Trump's insistence on loyalty might further hurt the GOP in the fall, he said. Under a normal administration, the president would understand if someone felt like they needed to distance themselves from him, Hansen said. The president would basically say, I need the Republican Congress. Do whatever you need to do to get yourself back in office. But we do not have a president who acts that way. In Wisconsin at the start of April, gas prices sat at roughly $3.77, according to AAA. Democrats there are keenly focused on Representative Derek Van Orden, a Republican whose district is considered a toss-up by most forecasters. He has described Iran as a destabilizing force in the Middle East that had to be stopped. Democratic challenger Rebecca Cook said voters are much more conscious of their basic needs than global conflicts and expect their representative to look out for them first and foremost. Voters in my district are promised no more forever wars, and I think that this is President Trump going back on that promise and not putting America first, she said. Putting ourselves in this conflict with Iran has only made things worse for, in particular, working-class Americans. And that article was entitled Dems Hoping Gas Prices Influence Voters. That was by Philip M. Bailey. Moving on to Valley and State News, this next article is entitled, How Can You Find Your School Superintendent's Salary? This is by Alexandra Hartle. Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a bill that would have made the salaries of all public school superintendents easily findable on a searchable database. House Bill 2075 was introduced by Representative David Livingston, a Peoria Republican. The bill would have required all public school districts in the state to submit employment contracts of superintendents, assistant superintendents, chief financial officers, and others to the Arizona Department of Education. The Department of Education would then have been responsible for creating an online searchable database with all of the contracts. It would include information such as the administrator's salary, performance-based pay, employer contribution for retirement, and how much leave and paid time off is awarded to the administrators. Because public school employees are government employees, their salaries are available publicly. But proponents of the bill said that information isn't always easily accessible. Here's how to see what your local district employees are making. Submit a public records request. The most straightforward and reliable way to see the salaries of administrators is to submit a public records request with the district. By doing so, all of the information will be sent directly to you. But staffing levels and workload at school districts mean the records may not get to you as fast as you want. Arizona law only requires that public records requests be responded to promptly. When speaking to the House Education Committee in January, Christopher Thomas, Director of Legal Strategy for Education Policy at right-leaning think tank Goldwater Institute, said the organization ran into trouble when submitting public records requests to districts. The information was not always readily available on public documents, and some districts took a long time to fulfill the requests, he said. Check the annual financial report. The latest annual financial report from the Arizona Department of Education only has data from fiscal year 2024. Districts were required to submit their 2025 reports in October. You can view data for each individual district on the Department of Education's website. Make sure to filter to fiscal year 2025 and select Annual Financial Report as the document type. To see all the data in one place, you can view the Arizona Department of Education's Annual Financial Report for fiscal year 2024. Examine board documents. A lot of information, including salaries, can be found in the superintendent's contracts. Those can sometimes be found by looking through school board documents, but they're not always easy to find. Mesa Public Schools Superintendent Matthew Strom's contract was approved at a December 2024 meeting for a term of 3 years. Peoria Unified School District Superintendent Casey Summers recently announced that he would be leaving at the end of the school year, meaning the school board can be expected to approve a new contract for the next superintendent at an upcoming board meeting. Summers' contract was initially approved in December 2023. But with both of those districts, the contract is not readily available on the district's board documents, meaning searching through the annual financial report or making a public records request may be the more reliable method of viewing their salaries. And that article is entitled, How Can You Find Your School Superintendent's Salary? That was by Alexandra Hartle. We're 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 19th, 2026. Continuing with Valley and State News, this next article is entitled Navajo Nation Reports Plague, Chickenpox, Measles Cases. This is by Arlissa DeBicenti. The Navajo Nation Department of Health and medical centers on and around the Navajo Nation have confirmed recent reports of plague, chickenpox, and measles over the past few weeks, prompting medical professionals to warn the public to remain vigilant. On April 8th, the Navajo Nation Department of Health confirmed a case of plague in a resident of Apache County who has since fully recovered. This is the first confirmed case in Apache County since 2015 and the fourth reported since 2006. Public health officials say the risk to the public remains low at this time. While plague is rare, we remain vigilant in protecting the health and safety of the Navajo Nation, said Health Department Executive Director Sherilyn Yazzie. Through strong partnerships and proactive public health response, we are working to ensure families have the information they need to reduce risk and protect themselves. Our priority is keeping our tribal communities safe through awareness, prevention, and early treatment. In February, confirmed chickenpox cases on the Navajo Nation were reported. At the time, the health department affirmed that chickenpox is a vaccine-preventable disease and encouraged all Navajo Nation residents to stay up to date with their vaccinations to provide immunity against dangerous diseases. Measles, a vaccine-preventable disease that was declared eliminated in 2000, has been confirmed near the Navajo Nation. A Coconino County resident tested positive on March 28th, following the first reported case of the year, which was announced on March 20th. The health department identified several locations in the border town of Page where potential exposures may have occurred and advised the public to monitor for symptoms. The department did not specify how many cases there have been or where cases on the Navajo Nation have been reported. Leaders and tribal members should be vigilant and proactive. Officials said chickenpox and measles are preventable if people take the needed steps. Leaders and tribal members should be vigilant and proactive, Dr. Kenneth Anim, Chief Medical Officer of Sage Memorial Ganado, told the Republic in an email. The risk to the general public remains low when people follow advisories, get vaccinated for chickenpox measles, practice good hygiene, avoid sick contacts, and report symptoms early. Sage Memorial Hospital is a private, nonprofit 501c3 corporation. It is the first Native-managed private comprehensive health care system in the country and has been managed since 1978 by an independent, entirely Navajo board of directors. The hospital has 25 beds and offers radiology, pharmacy, telemedicine, and a 24/7 emergency room. It also operates three field clinics in Greasewood, Wide Ruins, and Sanders. Anim said the plague is an endemic disease in the northern Arizona desert areas, but the incidence is extremely low, with only about one case per year reported. Measles and chickenpox, he said, tend to crop up as small epidemics, which are typically related to declines in vaccination rates among the childhood population. Vaccine recommendations have changed under Trump. Vaccines and immunizations have come under increased scrutiny during President Donald Trump's second term, with Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime vaccine skeptic, playing a prominent role. While making his second visit to the Gila River Indian community recently, Kennedy avoided the subject. The federal childhood vaccine schedule was recently revised, shifting six vaccines from recommended to a shared decision-making category. The Arizona chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics has said it will continue to follow the previous recommendations rather than adopt the new guidance. Vaccines affected by this change include influenza, rotavirus, COVID-19, meningococcal, hepatitis A, and hepatitis B. Many people don't realize how well organized and prepared Navajo Nation facilities are to prevent diseases. For chickenpox and measles, vaccines like varicella and MMR are available at IHS and tribal clinics, said Aneem. Sage Memorial, he said, provides community education and advisories, implements infection control measures, shares vaccination information, conducts monitoring and coordination efforts, and prepares staff and the community as part of its preventive measures. Risk to the general public remains low if basic precautions are followed, such as staying up to date on vaccinations. Sage Memorial also issued a chickenpox advisory and is encouraging routine immunizations. Immunization remains the cornerstone of prevention for chickenpox and measles, he said. Regarding the plague, Aneem advised the public to avoid contact with dead animals, especially rodents and prairie dogs, and to remove any rodent droppings around the home. Promptly removing ticks from the skin is an important precaution. Sage Memorial has been working hard to improve infection control in the hospital and is also sharing more information about vaccinations in our area, said Aneem. Sage Memorial also has a dedicated public health nurse team within the Community Health Division and an infection preventionist who together will conduct surveillance and screening for cases as well as begin contact isolation or make vaccination recommendations as needed. For more information about measles, visit the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, https://www.cdc.gov/measles/index.html, or contact the Navajo Department of Health at 928-357-6757, or the Navajo Epidemiology Center at 928-871-6539. And that article is entitled, Navajo Nation Reports Plague, Chicken, Measles Cases. That was by Arlissa D. Bacenti. This next article is entitled, State School Speech Bans a Problem. This is by Taylor Seeley. The majority of public school districts in Arizona have a ban on offensive speech that a federal appeals court says runs afoul of constitutional protections for free expression, putting parents at risk of civil rights violations and schools at risk of legal liability. A federal jury awarded a Tucson mom $200,000 after finding the Marana Unified School District retaliated against her for exercising her First Amendment free speech rights. The problem was the district's policy about public conduct on school property. The policy bans campus interference and disruption through the use of speech or language that is offensive or inappropriate for an educational environment. Marana officials had banned Rebecca Hartzell from school premises after an on-campus dispute between her and a school principal. The district argued it was because Hartzell had assaulted the school principal by grabbing her wrist, which Hartzell denied. The jury sided with the mom, finding that the school's ban was rather retaliation against Hartzell because she had repeatedly emailed and contacted officials with numerous complaints over the years. The April 2026 verdict came roughly a year after a three-judge panel on the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals wrote that Marana's policy contradicted constitutional speech protections. If there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive or disagreeable, Judge Milan Smith Jr. wrote. Yet more than a year has passed since that opinion was published, and nearly all public school districts in Arizona maintain the policy, including Marana. It can also be found in the Mesa, Chandler, and Tucson school districts, the largest districts in the state. That may be because most school districts adopt their policies from the Arizona School Board Association, which has not changed the rule. Spokesperson Heidi Vega said the association wasn't aware of the incident in Marana before the Arizona Republic brought it to their attention. Regardless of the association, school governing boards set school policy and could independently repeal or clarify the policy. Ali Benjamin, spokesperson for the Marana District, said, "While we acknowledge the court's ruling, our legal team is currently conducting a thorough review of the decision to determine our next steps." Benjamin left open the possibility of an appeal. The continued existence of the policy across Arizona schools, however, poses a risk to districts and parents alike. What happened to Hartzell could happen to more parents, and like Marana, other school districts could be forced to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages, with taxpayers footing the bill. That risk occurs particularly if schools enforce the rule the same way the jury found Marana did. The Ninth Circuit's opinion acknowledged public schools retain some authority to regulate speech. However, those regulations are limited to when the speech materially and substantially interferes with classwork or protecting or disciplining kids, the opinion says. Arizona School Board Association conducting policy review. Vega said that although the School Board Association wasn't aware of the Marana incident, the association's policy and legal teams were nonetheless reviewing the public conduct on school property policy as part of a comprehensive review of all of its policies. That review began last summer and is intended to ensure policies remain current, legally compliant, and clearly written for effective implementation, Vega said. Each section is reviewed as part of a structured timeline, with legal analysis, internal evaluation, and drafting updates occurring in phases, she said. It's unclear when the review will conclude. Vega said the priority was a thorough and thoughtful review rather than a rushed update. Does your school have this policy on the books? Parents and students can check their school district's policies by visiting azsba.org/services-resources/policy/. Click on the View Public Policies button by scrolling to the bottom of the page. That will open a web page with a list of public school districts. Click your school district, scroll to the Section K folder, then search for policy KFA, Public Conduct on School Property. And that article is entitled State School Speech Bans a Problem. That was by Taylor Seeley. We're going to move on to national and world news now with articles from USA Today. We've got two front page articles. One is on Obama and Virginia voting, and the second is on the war in the Middle East. The first article is entitled, Obama Stars in Ads for Both Sides in Virginia Vote. The subtitle is, State Set to Decide on New Congressional Map. This is by Nolan D. McCaskill. Republicans and Democrats vehemently disagree over whether Virginia should adopt a new congressional map for the November midterms, but they're leaning on the same person to sway voters to their side, former President Barack Obama. Ahead of Virginia's statewide special election on April 21st, Obama has become an omnipresent voice of an expensive, high-stakes campaign that could be critical in determining which party controls the House of Representatives after November's elections. The former president, once an opponent of gerrymandering, has endorsed efforts by Virginia's Democratic Party to allow the state's legislature to create new congressional districts that could give Democrats four additional seats in Congress, offsetting similar Republican efforts undertaken at President Donald Trump's behest in Texas and several other states. Obama's position shows how far Democrats have shifted on the issue in the wake of unprecedented Republican-led mid-decade efforts to redraw state congressional maps to help their party maintain control of Congress. But Republicans are hoping Virginia's voters are more swayed by what Obama has said in the past. Television and radio ads sponsored by two Republican groups used 2017 footage of Obama that blames gerrymandering for political polarization that's made it harder and harder to find common ground. They urge Virginians to vote no. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, said the Obama-centric messaging from Republicans shows their desperation. They wouldn't be lying about Obama's position if they weren't desperate and worried, Kaine said. Recent surveys of likely voters show the Yes campaign narrowly leading. More than 1 million people have voted early, according to the Virginia Department of Elections. Should the amendment pass, the new congressional districts would remain in place until after the 2030 census. Obama has appeared in mailers, radio spots, and TV ads for both sides of the issue, potentially confusing voters with mixed messaging led by groups with anodyne names. But Obama endorsed the referendum, appearing in a TV ad where he says, "Republicans want to steal enough seats in Congress to rig the next election and wield unchecked power for 2 more years, but you could stop them by voting yes by April 21st. Meanwhile, Virginians for Fair Maps, a Republican-led committee that has raised nearly $20 million, and Justice for Democracy PAC, a group funded by nearly $9 million from the conservative nonprofit Per Aspera Policy Incorporated, have led the opposition with Obama ads. Both groups' ads resurface Obama's April 2017 comments made at the University of Chicago. "Our President Barack Obama knows that partisan gerrymandering is wrong for our democracy. Listen to his words," a woman says in a Justice for Democracy radio ad. Representative Jen Kiggins, Republican of Virginia, said the strategy to leverage Democrats' past comments is one the Democratic Party would use if the tables were turned. "When you put those words in the public sphere, as a politician, they still exist," she said. "They don't go away just because you've changed your viewpoint." Redistricting wars. Currently, 6 Democrats and 5 Republicans compose Virginia's congressional delegation. A new map would give Democrats a 10-1 advantage in a Democratic-leaning state at the federal level. The additional 4 seats in Virginia would be enough to hand Democrats control of the House for the final 2 years of President Donald Trump's administration, following a flurry of moves by other states. The redistricting war started last year in Texas when, at Trump's direction, Republicans drew new maps designed to give their party as many as 5 additional congressional seats. California responded with a similar referendum that could garner Democrats a similar number of seats in that state. Ohio, Missouri, and North Carolina also changed their maps to further favor Republicans, with Florida poised to take up a new map soon. If this does not pass, Republicans could gerrymander in all the red states and hang on to the majority and continue to rubber stamp President Trump, said Representative Suhas Subramaniam, Democrat of Virginia. Virginia Republicans have criticized the map as an unfair redraw that would deprive half the state of fair representation and harm constituents' access to services that help them resolve issues with federal agencies. Democrats have made similar arguments in states that have been redistricted to favor Republicans. Representative Ben Klein, Republican of Virginia, did not address Republicans' use of Obama in advertising, but said that Democrats' nationalization of the statewide election would hurt their cause. "Enlisting national Democrats to try and push this egregious political hackery through is going to backfire," Klein said. "Republicans and independents and moderate Democrats are voting no, and we're going to defeat it on April 21st. an Obama spokesperson did not respond to a request for comment, but Obama has emphasized his position through Democratic advertising. "We can't afford two more years of unchecked power and zero accountability in Washington," Obama says in a Virginians for Fair Elections radio ad. "Help us chart a better path forward, Virginia." And that article is entitled, "Obama Stars in Ads for Both Sides in Virginia Vote." That was by Nolan D. McCaskill. Our second front page article from USA Today is entitled, "Iran Tightens Hormuz Control." The subtitle is, "Trump Warns Against Blackmail by Shutting Straight." This is by Trevor Honeycutt, Ariba Shahid, and Muhammad Al-Ghabali. Iran said it was tightening control over the Strait of Hormuz on April 18th, warning mariners the vital energy route was again closed. But President Donald Trump said Tehran could not blackmail the United States by shutting the waterway. Tehran said it was responding to a continued U.S. blockade of Iranian ports, calling it a violation of their ceasefire, while Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei said Iran's navy was ready to inflict new bitter defeats on its enemies. Shipping sources said at least two vessels reported coming under fire and being hit while trying to transit the waterway. India later said the Iranian ambassador in New Delhi had been summoned and that it had expressed deep concern to him that two Indian flagged ships had come under fire in the strait. State media in Iran quoted the Supreme National Security Council as saying Iranian control over the strait included demanding the payment of costs related to security, safety, and environmental protection services. State television also quoted the Supreme National Security Council as saying the United States had put forward new proposals after talks mediated by Pakistan in recent days. Tehran was considering them, but had not yet responded, it said. There was no immediate sign of direct U.S.-Iran talks taking place this weekend, despite Trump saying on April 17th that negotiations would take place. Uncertainty around conflict. Tehran's renewed tough messaging caused fresh uncertainty around the Iran conflict, raising the risk that oil and gas shipments through the strait could remain disrupted just as Washington weighs whether to extend the fragile ceasefire. Trump said the United States was having very good conversations with Iran, but that Tehran wanted to close the strait again. Iran could not blackmail the United States, he said. Maritime security and shipping sources said some merchant vessels had received radio messages from Iran's navy saying no ships were allowed through the waterway, reversing signs on April 17th that traffic might resume. Maritime trackers had earlier shown a convoy of eight tankers transiting the narrow passage in the first major movement of ships since the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran began 7 weeks ago. Hours earlier, Trump had cited some pretty good news about Iran, declining to elaborate. But he also said fighting might resume without a peace deal by April 22nd, when the two-week ceasefire expires. Iran had announced its temporary reopening of the Strait of Hormuz following a separate U.S.-brokered 10-day ceasefire agreement on April 16th between Israel and Lebanon. Israel invaded parts of southern Lebanon after the Iran-allied Hezbollah militant group joined the fighting in early March. But on April 18th, Iran's Armed Forces Command said transit through the strait had reverted to a state of strict Iranian military control, citing what it described as repeated U.S. violations and acts of piracy under the guise of a blockade. The spokesperson said Iran had earlier agreed in good faith to the managed passage of a limited number of oil tankers and commercial vessels following negotiations, but said continued U.S. actions had forced Tehran to restore tighter controls on shipping through the strategic choke point. U.S. Central Command said in a statement that American forces were enforcing a maritime blockade of Iran, but did not comment on the latest Iranian actions. No date for direct talks. The war with Iran began on February 28th with a U.S.-Israeli attack on the Islamic Republic. It has killed thousands, spread to Israeli attacks in Lebanon, and sent oil prices surging because of the de facto closure of the strait. Despite the initial movement of ships, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Sateeb Khatibzadeh said no date had been set for the next round of negotiations, adding that a framework of understanding must be agreed first. Pressure for a way out of the war has mounted as Trump's fellow Republicans defend narrow majorities in Congress in the November midterm elections, with U.S. gasoline prices high, inflation rising, and his own approval ratings down. The main thing is that Iran will not have a nuclear weapon. You cannot let Iran have a nuclear weapon, and that supersedes everything else, Trump said on April 17th. Trump also said he might end the ceasefire with Iran unless a long-term deal to end the war was agreed before it expires on April 22nd, adding that a U.S. blockade of Iranian ports would continue. There were no signs of preparations early on April 18th for talks in the Pakistani capital, where the highest-level U.S.-Iran negotiations since the 1979 Islamic Revolution ended without agreement last weekend. A Pakistani source aware of mediation efforts had said a meeting between Iran and the United States could produce an initial memorandum of understanding, followed by a comprehensive peace agreement within 60 days. Separately, a senior Iranian official said Tehran hoped a preliminary deal could be reached in the coming days. Oil prices fell about 10%, and global stocks jumped on April 17th on the prospect of marine traffic resuming through the strait. Despite that, hundreds of vessels and about 20,000 seafarers remained stranded in the Gulf, awaiting passage through the waterway, shipping sources said. At last weekend's talks, the United States proposed a 20-year suspension of all Iranian nuclear activity, while Iran suggested a halt of 3 to 5 years, according to people familiar with the proposals. Two Iranian sources have said there were signs of a compromise that could remove part of the stockpile. That is all the time that we have for with this article entitled, Iran Tightens Hormuz Control. That was by Trevor Honeycutt, Ariba Sahid, and Muhammad Al-Ghabali. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, April 19th, 2026. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take SunSounds with you. You can get our stream and on-demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.